40 years ago, you couldn't hardly drive in anywhere in East London without seeing the words spray painted on a building or a sidewalk, "Free Joe Pierce." In the early 80s, you'd see it all over East London, "Free Joe Pierce." 6 years ago, I was sitting in a pub on the campus of UMary with Joe Pierce, and he said I was not a good man. I thought I was big stuff. And he even said he had something of this, you know, small cult following. But I was not a good man. He said he was filled with hatred and violence. And he stirred that hatred and violence in others, and it came erupting out at others as well. He had spent one stint in jail when he was 21, and he said that did nothing. He was there 6 months, and he came out more angry than when he went in. And then when he was 24 years old, he was back in jail. And this time he was there for longer. And so he went, because he's had a lot more time, to the library, because he loved to read and they had nothing he liked to read there, but he started looking at different books. And you know how it is, you open the book and you just look page through it and you see if something catches your interest. If it doesn't, you put it aside. If it does, okay, start reading it. And so he did this. And he had been doing this for a number of months, and he noticed that all the books that he had been reading, he said he noticed, and he found out that they were all by these English Catholic authors. He tapped on his glass. He said, like this guy. The name of the pub is Chesterton's, and he was pointing to Chesterton. G.K. Chesterton. Hilaire Belloc. J.R.R. Tolkien. He said they were incredibly intelligent and clever, but he couldn't get over the fact that they also took Jesus seriously. And he was puzzled by this. Because he had said, he didn't describe it this way, but he said it was almost like when he was a little kid, he grew up and, you know, he knew the Christmas story and he'd been taught just enough Christianity where it was like he was immunized, where he'd received just enough so he was able to resist the rest of it. So it's like, well, I know Christianity, I know Jesus, I know that whole story. But here he encountered these people in these books. He said, books are dangerous. In these books, these people who Jesus had entered their lives, and he wanted to be able to see that Jesus. Not the little Jesus that he had grown up thinking was who he was, but rather this expansive, vast God who became man in this Jesus. He said at first it was his mind wanting to see Jesus as these men saw him. And it was his mind that was converted first. But Jesus was wanting to get in somewhere else, he said. He was wanting to get in here. He was wanting to enter into his soul. And he said, well, the only thing I knew how to do with that was open the door and let him in. And so he said for the first time in his life, he prayed. And when he describes it, when he talks about his conversion experience, he said it was like the verses from Amazing Grace had become flesh for him. That it was this flooding of grace into his soul that was saving a wretch like him. This man that we hear about in the gospel, Zacchaeus, when we are introduced to him, he is not a good man. He's a little man, is the first thing we hear about him. He's the patron saint for all you Dickinson High alumni. Today is their patron saint day, Zacchaeus. But here's the thing. He's described as a little man in the Gospels, but the Gospel writer doesn't describe him as a little man just to tell us that he might have been short. He may have been short, who knows? What it's describing, though, is his spiritual state. This is a man who has a very short, small soul. There are great-souled people, people with magnanimous souls, people whose souls are pouring out love and pouring out themselves. And then there are small-souled people, people who have souls that have become small and shriveled. This is Zacchaeus when we meet him. God, though, God is not small. God is vast and huge. We hear in the reading from Wisdom the vastness of God's mercy and the vastness of him who created everything. A couple years back, there was a church in Bismarck which had a sign out in front of it that said, God created us so he would have someone to love. It's the stupidest sign in front of a church I've ever seen. It's so dumb because it's so wrong. And so this is where all the violence and the hatred starts bubbling out of my own heart, because I wanted to go burn down the sign. I'm like, well, if the sign goes, yeah. Because it's wrong. God doesn't need us. God created. Why did he create us? Why did he create all of this? He didn't create so that he'd have someone to love. God is love. He is a trinity of persons. He is this complete exchange of love. He does not need us. But this tells us something about God and the vastness of him. He doesn't need us, and so why did God create? He created out of sheer gift. He created out of pure, amazing grace. Everything he created, all of creation, is charged with God's grace. He created purely because of love. And not out of a need love, but out of a pure, agape love. A love which gives and pours itself out in complete magnanimity. And so Zacchaeus, we hear him here. And whenever we hear a character in Scripture, in a parable, or that Jesus encounters, we're meant to recognize that that Zacchaeus is not just some bad guy, and yet Jesus saves bad people sometimes, like him and Joseph Pierce. No, I'm meant to see that Zacchaeus, that's me. That's you in Zacchaeus. That when we sin, when we remove ourselves from this life of God, this life of grace, what happens to our souls is they become very small. They become shriveled. And the reality and the honesty that this can be me oftentimes. Yes, I've received the enormity of God's, his mercy, his love, but yet my own soul gives very little of that. My soul can become very small. But that's not the end of the story. Because the smallness of this man's soul is transformed when it encounters the greatness of God's love, the magnanimity of God's love in Jesus. This little man, he climbs the tree, just wanting to see Jesus. Not expecting that he would be seen by Jesus. And in the one gaze, the one look of Jesus to him, every ounce of God's love is poured into him in that moment. And it changes something within him. It changes something. He comes down, and Jesus wanted in. And he didn't just want to enter into a little part of his life. He wanted into the whole house, the whole of his life. And this little souled man, we see this transformation into a heart that's now desiring to be magnanimous, to be great-souled. I will give everything I have to the half of what I own to the poor. And to those I've stole from, I will pay them back four times the amount. Joseph Pierce, in his autobiography, which is called Racing the Devil, he writes that one of the hardest things is, yes, he had this encounter with Christ where intellectually his mind was converted and he wanted to see Jesus, right? And then he had this encounter in prayer where Jesus, and he experienced his love for the first time, really alive. But that wasn't the wholeness, that wasn't the entirety of his story. He still, after he converted in 1989, he had to go back and everybody he knew in his life, he still had those relationships. A lot of them he had to cut off. He had to go and make those changes in his life. But he had to remember that what he saw and what he encountered in Jesus, that was real. And he had to continually look and keep sight of Jesus in his life and what Jesus was doing to not lose sight of him. Because Zacchaeus, what happens with Zacchaeus 2 weeks from then? 2 months from this moment that we hear about. 2 weeks from here, where Zacchaeus is getting out his checkbook and now he's going to write a check. And he's going to give away half his property to the poor, like his heart was moved to. And all of a sudden he's like, well, maybe I just got caught up in the moment. He's second-guessing himself. No, he had to remember. I saw Jesus and I saw him looking upon me. And I encountered him and that was real. And he has to be looking in that present moment to see Jesus, to see what he's doing. 2 months from now, when he's going back to those people he robbed and giving back four times the amount he took, and all of a sudden he's getting ready to go to another person and he's overwhelmed by this shame of not wanting to face them, what gives him the strength to go? It's the grace of remembering and making alive again that it was Jesus I encountered. It was his love that gazed upon me. And that love and that gaze, I have to be looking for that now. Can I see that now? It's alive. Everyone, you've encountered Jesus. You've seen him. And more, you've seen him gazing upon you. He's entered in. He desires to enter even further in. But that's real. That encounter was real. And to keep sight and to be able to see that was real and to be able to see what God is doing in your life now. Can you see? When you look back over the last weeks, the last months, the last year, can you see what God's grace has been doing in your life? The people he's brought into your life, the things he's done, the events that have been there, some of them filled with joy and some of them that are incredibly hard. Can you see God's grace at work in the midst of that? To see that, to be able to receive the greatness of God's grace into the oftentimes smallness and shriveledness of our souls and to allow it to be transformed so that our souls become vast and magnanimous. The greatness of God's grace, which saved a wretch like me. I was lost and now I'm found. I was blind, but now I see.